Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer günstig und natürlich mit dem Aldi-Tiefpreisversprechen. Zum Beispiel knackiges Gemüse, saftiges Obst, frische Backwaren. Kurz gesagt, mehr Frische für alle. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote zum Tiefpreis in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, Kat. How are you doing? The year's almost done.
Yeah, I'm about ready to go on vacation. I'm going to be away for a three-day weekend. That's why we're recording this episode slightly early, but not that early. And then next week, of course, is Thanksgiving, the American holiday that you Canadians do not partake in.
No, but I do have an American husband, so we are going to have, like, a turkey.
Now is the time that we get to delve into our backlog. Are there any games that you're planning to play over the holiday, like, and the rundown to the holidays so that you can brush up on Game of the Year stuff?
I really want to try to get Disco Elysium on my PC. It should be able to run it. Once we actually hit vacation and, like, the Game of the Year stuff is really out of the way, I'm thinking I have two major plans. I have Switcher. And I really want to start Final Fantasy 14. Like, all my friends are playing it right now, and I want to be cool as well.
Yeah, I think I am also going to play Disco Elysium. I really enjoyed a thread that Katie posted in Slack that was talking about how it is very much about a leftism that might be a little bit foreign to American leftists, in the sense of it was made by people from Eastern Europe who maybe mm-hmm. have kind of personal experience with the Soviet Union and whatnot. And it apparently talks a lot about good intentions, but also looks to kind of the gritty aspects of dealing with, well, being on the streets and the poor and, like, the actual day-to-day of idealism rather than the top level, like, let's fix things.
Yeah. That's exactly it, like, the whole, like, good intentions and what comes to them, and we all know what the road to hell is paved with. So, yeah, that's one reason I'm also kind of looking forward to just diving into Disco Elysium before the year's out.
Yes, so, yeah, and I guess I'm going to just keep playing Pokemon, which I'm really enjoying so far.
I keep going back to Pokemon. I keep saying, okay, you know what, maybe I'll start Switcher now, but then I boot up my Switch, and I'm like, oh, you know what, there's, like, I want to see what the weather is so I can catch, like, I really want to catch a Dreepy. Which is like a ghost, I don't know if you've seen one, but it's a ghost dragon Pokemon. It's really adorable, and it evolves into something that's completely out of this world, so I'm already in love with it, and I want to catch one and make it my friend.
I am in the process of capturing basically anything that I see.
Yeah, that's a good way to do it, too.
Yeah, because I'm not that far in, ultimately. I just beat the first gym, finally. Which, by the way, the first gym is quite late in this game.
It is, yeah. I think they mean you to really take your time exploring the wild area, which you're not the only one I'm hearing that from. People saying, oh, I didn't get to the wild area for a very long time, whereas I got to it fairly early because when I was playing the game, the wild area didn't have the servers on, so it was like, okay, this is cool, I'm going back to the game now. But now that the wild area, the servers are on, it really is a totally different place.
I spent a hot minute exploring the wild area, but then I found a lot of monsters that were kind of above my level.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, I should go.
I shouldn't take on this level 30 monster when I am like level 10.
I love the camping so much. I love having a first-person view of my little Pokemon running around, and I have a ball, and it runs up to me and like makes little hearts. I'm like, I don't even care about you, but you're so cute. I'm going to toss the ball. Oh my God, the Yamper is going after the ball and it's wagging its little corgi tail.
Little corgi butt. That's I've actually seen on Twitter, and Twitter's actually great for this, just the different interactions people have had that I haven't had. For example, there was someone who put up a video yesterday of two of their Pichus racing each other, and I haven't had that happen to me yet. And there was another instance where someone was just camping on one of the routes and a Pokemon came up to them and, like, basically asked, like, not in so many words, but like, hey, can I join you? And And if you say yes, like, it goes into a Pokeball and becomes part of your party. And I thought that was really, really cool.
I have been wanting something like this for I don't even know how long. So it is so exciting to me to finally have it realized on the Nintendo Switch, and honestly realized pretty well. So I also think it's pretty funny that Pokemon Sword and Shield really leans into the soccer thing so much as a soccer fan. I feel like, man, they really have some serious soccer fans on this team. Like, the first gym is basically Allianz Arena from Germany. The Bayern Munich stadium that also was kind of copied for the Minnesota United Stadium in MLS, with the big kind of glass dome kind of look to it. It looked very cool and also very familiar.
That's actually like one of the reasons I was like looking forward to you playing the game, because I knew you'd spot all these soccer references that went right over my head.
I feel like there's at least one other soccer reference. But then I like the opening ceremonies. It's very Champions League. And mm-hmm. I love going into a field with a giant crowd cheering me on and gasping as things are happening. It makes the gym battles feel much bigger than they have in previous games. And I also like that the crowds look better in Pokemon Sword and Shield than they do in FIFA.
That's really, really hilarious. But I did notice how the crowds, like, they wave banners, and when you are on, like, the last Pokemon whenever you're on the trainer's last Pokemon, the music changes and it gets a lot more intense, and you can hear the cheering and the chanting a lot more clearly.
Yeah, and when it's really cool when they Dynamax, it has a feeling to it like, oh, things just got real. And I could Dynamax too, but I kind of didn't want to. It was actually more fun to fight them as a small version.
Yeah, I usually just do it for the spectacle, but you can absolutely fight them small if you're like, I don't want to bother, because honestly, it is a bit of a long animation. But there is a certain sense of presence where you Dynamax and the Pokemon just kind of falls on the ground and like breaks everything, and it just is pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. The little flourishes with the trainers as well, where they're like, ah, now I'm going to use my ultimate move and everything. It feels like I'm watching the anime.
It does. It is kind of a strange combination, but a really effective one, of the anime and sports culture in the UK.
Yes. I mean, honestly, the cross reference for me is perfect. So I'm, of course, going to end up digging Pokemon Sword and Shield. Also, my Score Bunny has evolved into Raboot.
That is such a bad name. Yeah, yes. He becomes Raboot, all right.
And I'm carrying around also the Yamper, and I went and caught a Woobat because I recognize what it evolves into, and I'm like, oh, I like that thing when it evolves. I think it's from like Gen 6.
Yeah, I think that's Noivern or something.
Yeah, Wybrat or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've been naming them after soccer players. So there's a striker for Chelsea named Michi Batsuai. So I named the Woobat Batsuai.
You got to fit within 12 characters.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think of names for all of the ones that I actually care about. I seem to be using this one bird that you get right at the beginning quite a bit, and it just evolved. Ooh. And I have the little fox thing that evolves into the big fox thing that's a dark type.
Oh, the Nickit? Yeah. Yeah, I would say hang on to that Rookity. It becomes pretty cool.
Oh, is that the one who eats the Pikachu?
No, that's the Cramorant.
Okay.
Which is a great name.
It's funny. The birds in Pokemon actually have a pretty rich history, the starting birds. Like, I've always been partial to Pidgeot. And then in Diamond and Pearl, not Diamond and Pearl. Oh, yeah, no, Diamond and Pearl had a cool one. And also Black and White had a pretty cool one. And my favorite one was actually in X and Y. It's the Talonflame, which was a big red bird that used fire-type moves and had a special move that effectively allowed it to always go first. So if you powered up its attack, like, it could be a perfect in-game sweeper. It was a lot of fun to use.
Yeah, I've seen Braviary in a lot of competitions.
So I'm hoping that Sword and Shield's bird continues in that grand tradition. But Yeah, so I was playing Pokemon Sword and Shield quite a bit last night and really enjoying it. You know what other RPG I've been playing that I've been really enjoying?
What's that?
Ring Fit.
Oh, really? So you got it?
Yeah, I totally got it. And let me tell you, it's a pretty intense workout. I was sore the next day.
Yeah, I hear it's really fun and actually very good, and it's selling quite well. It's been on the charts for a while now.
It's a dumb but brilliant idea of where you're like actually jogging along and you're kind of aiming the ring, shooting it at things, but then you get into random encounters, but your attacks are exercises.
Yeah, it sounds really fun. I'm actually hoping that Nintendo continues to support it with DLC.
It seems much better than Wii Fit, just because you attach the little strap to your leg and then you have the actual ring. And so you can do things like put the ring down, get on your back, and then do like leg extensions and it's a good core workout, and also squats and everything. Like, it hits all of the different essential parts of the body for its exercises. I think it's really well designed.
Yeah, I did Wii Fit, and Wii Fit really wasn't a great workout. The whole balance thing was kind of okay, I suppose. I don't think there's any real science behind it.
It was also focused on, I think, BMI, which
it was
isn't
very
the greatest
focused on
measure.
BMI. No, it's even my doctor, who's quite like conservative old guy, says BMI is useless. I mean, every time I get on that scale, I'd hear, "Oh my God, you're so obese because your BMI is so high." It's like, "Ah, screw you!" So I finally got fed up. It's like, I don't come here. I don't play video games every day to hear how fat I am.
All right, and on that note, let's ask the Plug Odd US Gamer Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, can I recommend that you leave a review, a positive one, preferably, on our podcast, wherever you consume your podcast product, probably iTunes, maybe Stitcher, perhaps over on Spotify. Yeah, leave us a review and a rating, and we really appreciate it. It brightens our day, and it also improves the visibility of the podcast. If you had feedback or a topic you want to discuss, why don't you send me a DM on Twitter? My DMs are open. I'm on Twitter at @the_catbot, or you can send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net. We have a newsletter for the podcast that comes out every single Wednesday. Nadia has a topic that she sends, and also what the latest RPG headlines were. Nadia, what was your topic this week?
Well, since we're kind of done for RPG big releases for the year, I talked a little bit about asking people if they've secured their RPGs of the year yet. I think I've got my ducks in a row, or my dragons in a row, if you will, because it's a very predictable year outside of maybe Disco Elysium, which again I have to try for myself before I can say yes or no. But it's like Dragon Quest XI S. Okay, great game, great port of a great game. Sure, that's easily on.
It's just a port. A great port. It's a great port. But are we really going to name DQ11 one of the best RPGs 2 years in a row?
It's just on my personal list. I mean, not just because of the fact that it's a great port, but it also has a lot of new content. So it's not just like, oh, okay, here you go. A decent port for the Switch. It does actually have enough quality of life and new content improvements to make me say, okay. But really, I'll probably end up giving it to Dragon Quest Builders 2. So there's another Dragon Quest for you.
Dragon Quest Builders 2.
Me, Mike, and Eric. Is it going to be a thorn in your side for the rest of your life, Kat?
The freaking cartel is going to get it put into the goddamn top 50 of our freaking top 100 decade list. What the hell? What wrong
cartel?
With you people?
Is there a Dragon Quest cartel going on or something, you think?
I'm fine with Dragon Quest XI being on there, but Dragon Quest Builders 2 is just a weird choice. It is.
Because it's a good game. Sometimes good games are weird choices.
But is it one of the top 100 best games of the decade? No, it's
yes.
Not. There are better games.
No, there isn't.
Okay, I'm not starting this. Okay. Yeah, so subscribe to our newsletter. It is... you can find the subscription information on the site, and you will get it every single Wednesday, and you'll get to see Nadia's lovely writing in your mailbox every single week. Speaking of awards, the Game Award nominations came out, And there are some weird choices in there, Nadia.
Yeah, some weird omissions as well.
Yeah, I mean, you look at best RPGs, right? And here are the best RPG choices. Disco Elysium, okay, good choice.
Okay.
Which, by the way, though, it should be in the Game of the Year category. That's fair.
Yeah.
That's too bad. Final Fantasy XIV.
Shadowbringers?
Wouldn't that be best ongoing game?
I would put it under best ongoing game because, yes, Shadowbringers was apparently excellent. It's one thing I want to experience this holiday, hopefully. But sure, okay.
Kingdom Hearts 3?
Sure. Got to have it somewhere, I guess.
I don't think it's going to be on our top 20.
No, I mean,
I don't think Katie nominated it, and she would be the only one to nominate it.
Yeah, so from what I gathered from her, it's a really fun, good, solid game, but, you know, forgettable in the end.
It's like a throwback to the PS2 days.
Exactly.
I started some consternation. My Slack logo now is that damn cat.
Did you know that cat's Canadian?
Of course it is.
Its name is Smudge. It's from Ottawa.
Well, yeah, so Kingdom Hearts 3. I started some consternation on Twitter when I said that Kingdom Hearts was never good.
That sounds like something you would say.
But it wasn't. It never was good. It was always a pretty one-dimensional action RPG that had some pretty surface-level Disney references. Never had that great of a story. I mean, it's just people remember it fondly because of nostalgia.
It was like, I watched some of a playthrough of 3, and it was a little bit strange because it was like, okay, here's the famous Let It Go scene, but we've got Roxas. Was it Roxas?
Sora.
Sora and Goofy and Donald are just there off to the side saying, hey, someone's singing. Let's go check out who it is. And it's like, okay, sure. That's a little strange.
Yeah, I think the problem with Kingdom Hearts is, so it definitely appeals to Disney nuts.
Yes, which is
I am
fair.
Not a huge Disney nut. Like, I know people who go to Disneyland multiple times a year, and I'm like, you're crazy. But at the same time, like, I don't have any problem with Disney. I like Disney films broadly. I didn't really feel like Kingdom Hearts ever really truly nailed the Disney stuff. And if you strip away the Disney stuff, which is consistently the best part of Kingdom Hearts, it does not stand on its own.
Yeah. One thing I do appreciate about it, though, is that it utilizes one of the strongest spells, not just in the Final Fantasy universe, but in the whole Square Enix universe, and that's Zeta Flare. And that's cast by Donald freaking Duck. He can cast Zeta Flare, like the world-ending spell of the Square Enix universe. And he screams it in that weird Donald Duck voice of his, which makes it even better.
All right, that's pretty cool.
It is.
Monster Hunter World Iceborne. I mean, we talk about it a lot on this podcast. I think I've said in the past that it has some pretty strong RPG elements.
Right.
It's a little debatable in some ways about whether it should be on this list. I would be more inclined to put it under action.
Yeah.
And then Outer Worlds, which is, yes, that's a good choice.
Yeah, I never got to play Outer Worlds. I don't know if we get to play it this year, but you seem to like it.
I dug it. I don't think it's as good as Disco Elysium. It's too bad that Pokemon didn't come out in time to be nominated because it should definitely be on this list.
Yeah, I would have put it on the list personally.
Yeah. And then, of course, Fire Emblem Three Houses should be on this list, but it is under strategy.
Okay, maybe, sure, but what a weird award ceremony.
Yeah, and then Game of the Year. Here are the Game of the Year nominations. Control, Death Stranding, Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, Resident Evil 2, Sekiro, and The Outer Worlds. I don't know that I agree with any of those games as potential Game of the Year candidates.
Maybe Smash, which I know it's fair to vote it as a 2019 game because it came out so late last year. And it has actually had so much added to it. But other than that, it's like, well, I never played Control, so I can't say one way or the other. As for the rest of it, it's like, meh.
Control Death Stranding was a really cool mess.
I've heard that.
Death Stranding was, I mean, that's like a Rorschach test of games. Like, it's really a question of what you want to get out of games is what you'll get out of Death Stranding, honestly.
There is going to get, like, Game of the Year anyway, so, like.
Not from us.
No, not from us, but from Keighley, of course it will.
I mean, let's give Keeley a break here. I mean, it's not like he nominated them. Like, outlets, as I said on Twitter, outlets were busy playing Death Stranding at the time that these ballots came out, so it was very top of mind. And that's why I got a lot of nominations. Like, it probably got more nominations than maybe we would have given it if not for the fact that we were playing it at that exact moment, so we were thinking about it a lot.
True.
So it was just natural for, you know, it to come up. It's like, oh, yeah, no, it was a really good score, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, Control, Death Stranding, Smash Brothers Ultimate, Resident Evil 2, Sekiro, and The Outer Worlds. Which, okay, yeah, like, so I think I said that my personal game of the year is Fire Emblem Three Houses, and I don't know if that should be necessarily in the game of the year slot, but I think The Outer Wilds and Disco Elysium are two gigantic omissions.
Yeah, did The Outer Wilds get any nominations? I hope
Best
it got
indie.
Something. Just indie, eh? Because that was such a really... admittedly, I had problems with my copy because I found it did not run well on my Xbox whatsoever, but the idea... And the story and the concept, that really just blew my mind at the time. I really enjoyed that the world building they had going on there.
If you want to talk about games that we'll still be talking about 5 years from now, I don't think any of those games that are in the Game of the Year category necessarily fill the bill. I think that, on the other hand, I think Disco Elysium, Outer Wilds, and certainly Untitled Goose Game are all games that we'll be talking about in 5 years.
Yeah, most certainly. I am glad to see Sayonara Wild Hearts as one of my dark horses this year, and it did get at least, like, nominations, for, I think, for, not even for indie, but, like, for music at least. So I'm happy to see that.
Well, the good news is that the Game Awards are not the be-all and end-all. There's also the Game Developers Choice Awards. There's also the BAFTAs and various other, and that's where we tend to see a little more balance come in. I seem to recall that Red Dead Redemption 2 got, like, a single solitary nomination at the Game Developers Choice Awards after basically sweeping the Game Awards last year.
Did it? It only got, like, because, I mean, it's not like I look back on Red Dead Redemption 2 and say, oh, why were we even in love with that game? That was a bad game.
I think Oberdin ended up being the top game of the Game Developers Choice Awards.
Well, yeah, I guess I'd much rather see it go to Oberdin, like such a great but lesser-known game versus a big AAA Rockstar game, even though I did like RDR2 very much.
Anyway, it seems like Outer Worlds ended up being kind of the big winner in terms of RPGs on this list just by virtue of the fact that it got into the Game of the Year category. Because I guess people really, 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 really wanted it to be the alternative to Fallout 76.
Yeah, I will say that much. I mean, and good for them. What can I say? I have nothing against them. Maybe it's not really truly Game of the Year, but hey, go for it. Strive. Only shooting stars break the mold and all that.
Anyway, the Game Awards are going to be on December 11th, I think it is. I was going to go down to... No, it's going to be December 12th. I was going to go down to L.A. to actually be there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but... Instead, I'm going to England, so...
So you're not going to be there for the U.S. Gamer Game Awards Slumber Party, where we're all up until 11 o'clock.
No, I'll be there. I'll be at the Slumber Party. It's just I wasn't going to go to L.A., come back, and then go to England.
Oh, so you're really going to be up late, because it's like, God, last year at 11 o'clock, we were all like, oh my God, please let this end. And I mean, there was that really cool live performance of the RDR2 music, but otherwise it was like, I'm in pain, my whole body hurts, it is almost midnight. Please let me die.
So that's the Game Awards. Now, let's move on, Nadia, to the mailbag. So on your Axe of the Blood God notes, it says, it's letter time at the top of this, so which I kind of appreciate. It makes me think of like Sesame Street or Pee Wee Herman or something.
It's actually a reference to that that Canadian game show I'm writing about where the host would always get letters and he'd say, it's letter time, so it was so low budget. It's just one of the things he always did.
Okay, so the first letter is from FTL Mantis, and FTL Mantis writes, the reason I personally liked Emerald Ruby Sapphire so much is that it's the first game where the increased Pokemon variety combined with increased system complexity to make the collection battle system compelling. I feel like every time I revisit Gens 1 and 2, I'm stuck with essentially the same team through the first half of the game. Gen 3 gives more interesting typing options on dead-end Pokemon right from the start. This is another thing as Sword and Shield does well, too. Add in the fact that I personally find the art style and starters very compelling, and it's clear why it's subjectively one of my favorites. And then they apologize for people being mean to Callie. So this is in response, Nadia, to our conversation last week with Callie Plaguey, where we said that I was basically like, I don't understand the love for Pokemon Emerald and Ruby and Sapphire, because it, in many ways, like if those games had come out in 2019, you think the Twitter firestorm now was bad? Holy cow. The only reason that it wasn't more of a thing was because Pokemon wasn't what it is now, and because social media didn't exist.
Yeah, it was definitely social media didn't exist, because I remember there was some unrest amongst reviewers about Sapphire and Ruby, but other than the reviewers, no one really had a way to contact them except, you know, maybe through email and maybe, you know, on a message board somewhere. But there was definitely nothing in the way of Twitter or YouTube or anything that makes it easy for you to get fed rage.
I remember sitting on the IGN boards and complaining about it constantly.
Did you seriously?
Oh, people were so mad that all 386 Pokemon were actually in the game, but that they were locked away.
See, I didn't know they were locked away for a very long time.
People would Game Shark it just to access like Charizard and such, and they were like, screw you, I paid for the data.
Well, that's fair, I suppose.
Yeah, so, and then beyond that, like, it cuts so many features from Gold and Silver, which, I mean, we already talked about. It does, I think, have three of the strongest starters out of any of the Pokemon games. I am extremely fond of Mudkip, Treecko, and Torchic. And ultimately, yeah, it did actually add some compelling... It on the back end, it did a huge amount to bring Pokemon into where it is now by introducing things like abilities and traits. It redid the IV system into a way that is still pretty much used today. It redid the EV system in a way that's pretty much used today, which is like a big part of why the Pokemon from Gold and Silver were mostly not that useful or weren't able to easily be transferred over to Ruby and Sapphire. And just by adding in abilities like Levitate, you kind of transformed Pokemon like Koffing or Gengar, because suddenly they had Levitate, which meant that you couldn't use Earthquake on them, which meant that like all of a sudden they were that much stronger because one of the key attacks was no longer useful. It really added a lot of different dimensions to the competitive metagame. But that was also very much of the time, and yeah. Pokemon has evolved a lot since then. So a lot of that stuff is kind of lost to time, as it were. And honestly, like if we want to talk about like favorite metagames, I still prefer Diamond and Pearl. I think that was my favorite one. Not the least because you couldn't tell what people would lead with, so the Pokemon you led with was actually a really interesting strategy, and it added a lot of things that I really enjoyed, like there was a certain move where you would attack, and then you would flip out and change, which, U-turn, like adding U-turn did so much for the metagame, right? Made it so much fun, like it added a flow and a movement to it that I really enjoyed. Ruby and Sapphire's metagame was actually a little bit limited in some respects. Though I think the 200 metagame was better than a lot of people remember.
I just remember playing Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire, and just I don't even think I finished it, because as much as people rag on IGN for that, you know, 7.7 too much water or whatever it was, I understand what they were saying, because you had to call up an HM even in the remake to sail through the water, and there was a lot of damn water in Hoenn.
Yeah, and also the villains in that game were weird.
They were really weird.
They're like, their whole shtick was, we want to flood the earth or we want to cause massive droughts. So I'm like, I think both are bad.
Yeah, one of the funniest comics I ever saw, and I think of it all the time, is Archie is standing with the trainer from that game, and everything's flooded. You know, this terrible storm is here, and like, Archie says, oh, this is terrible. This isn't what I wanted at all. And the trainer says, well, what did you want? And you see, just see Archie imagining himself with this crayon drawing, like him and Kyogre, and says best friends, and there's like a rainbow over rainbow over them.
Yeah, I mean, I think Emerald is still really strong for the most part because
it is, yes, definitely.
Because it combined Ruby and Sapphire into one game. And so you were fighting both Team Magma and Team Aqua. So it made a lot more sense. There was a lot more story content to it as a result. It added things like the ability to go into another person's fort and battle level 100 Pokemon, which was actually kind of cool.
That was pretty cool. I love the forts.
And also it added a new ending with Rayquaza, as I've learned it's pronounced.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes.
Resolving the battle between Kyogre and Gruden. And it actually had a really cool cutscenes. And then in the post game, of course, you had the Battle Frontier, which was just aces. It was so good. Yeah, I was always a little salty that Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire avoided all the Emerald stuff, and in many respects was kind of a step back for a remake, which is weird.
Yeah, I didn't finish it, which is rare for me. I usually at least finish a Pokemon game, even if I don't get into the metagame.
All right, John Cutting says, Bahamut Lagoon is the next game in Square's lockbox that needs the Romancing Saga 3 treatment. It's a gorgeous game with a huge, interesting cast that also bucks a lot of the fantasy tropes to make compelling vignettes into each character's life. It reminds me a lot of a proto-Normandy, where my favorite part of Bahamut Lagoon in Mass Effect is growing around the ship in between missions to see how each person's story has developed. So yeah, Bahamut Lagoon, Nadia, I feel like is a little more obscure than it deserves. As I was telling you off-air, I always kind of mixed it up with Secret of Evermore in my head.
Which is the funniest thing to me, because the games couldn't be any more different. It's like one is Western developed, the other one's very Japanese, one's an action RPG, and the other one's a strategy RPG. It's and they don't even look anything alike.
No, they really don't. Totally different aesthetic. Bahamut Lagoon looks, you know, like late era Super Nintendo game with the really nice kind of hand-drawn sprite-based graphics, right, that kind of are mindful of Final Fantasy VI, and I think it works really well.
And the enemies were animated, too.
Yeah, exactly. I agree that it would be nice for Bahamut Lagoon to come back. Like when you're looking over it, the story kind of reminds me a little bit of Final Fantasy XII.
Yeah, it definitely had a sort of a mix of machinery and fantasy. More of an emphasis on fantasy because, of course, you had the whole concept was not only did you have your characters who you used in a traditional strategy game sense, but also each squadron had a dragon. And the dragon could transform, it could take on different elements, it could... it has some pretty cool designs, I have to say. Some of them weirder than others, but depending on what you fed them, they would change form. And I don't remember what the whole, mechanics behind that was, but you will find plenty of guides still that walk you through it.
I thought you said you were feeding them porno magazines.
You can feed them porno magazines. You absolutely can.
See, that's some Secret of Evermore stuff right there.
I don't think Evermore has porno magazines. Audience, please correct me if I'm wrong.
I like that it has a character named Princess Yo-Yo.
It does have a character named Princess Yo-Yo. And actually, the localization, fan translation, was done by Clyde Mandelin, who, of course, did Mother 3 and is a professional translator now.
So is Bahamut Lagoon easy to access? Because it seems like it is relatively difficult to play these days.
If the only way I know of is a ROM and the translation patch. To my knowledge, it has never received any sort of re-release, maybe not even in Japan. I would absolutely love to see it on the Switch. That would be my ideal sort of fantasy. Because it's, as someone who was not good at strategy games when she played Bahamut Lagoon and still isn't that great at them, it's a pretty accessible strategy RPG, and that's mainly because the dragons kind of break the game, but in a fun way.
You and dragons. You really love your dragons.
I always have since I was a very little girl, apparently.
I think that it seems like a good candidate to go on Steam, because Square Enix seems to love their dump their games on Steam. And they seem to be a lot better about actually doing the port right these days, ever since they did that horrible art style in Final Fantasy VI, and then, of course, messed up the Chrono Trigger port.
Yeah, yeah. So if they could do it in a way that would, you know, not turn the game into a visual horror show, I would absolutely be down for putting it anywhere where it is easily accessible, has an official translation, even though the fan translation is very good. Just give it the Trials of Mana treatment, because look what they just did just this year. I'd love to see it.
Okay, Gordon Law says, I have a question about backlog. Are you the type of person like myself to have a maximum of 3 games on the back burner, or are you the type of person to only play 1 game at a time? Additionally, if a game has been on the backlog for a while without touching it, when do you cut your losses and drop it altogether? Is there a healthy balance between the two? Well, Gordon, as a professional game reviewer, I can tell you that everything's on the backlog at all times.
Pretty much. I will say that the Switch has made it a bit easier to get through my backlog, because it's like I could play my PlayStation 4, and then when someone else needs a TV, I just play my Switch. But I always have that backlog. I never win against that backlog. The only time I really cut my losses and I try to fool myself into saying that I'll come back someday is when I really need the space on my PlayStation 4 or my Switch, and I say, well, this giant-ass RPG has got to go. I swear to God, I'll re-download it someday and get back to it.
There are some games. There are 2 types of games. Maybe 3. Okay. Type 1 is the game I'm never going to play anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Type 2 is the game that I'm like, I would like to play this game. It is on my backlog. It is sitting there on my computer and or on my Switch or wherever. But I never really get around to it. And number 3 is the game that I'm like, no, I am going to beat this freaking game. I am going to keep noodling away at it. I'm going to keep coming back. I would say Dragon Quest XI S is on that list.
Mm-hmm.
I would say Persona 5 is on that list. I would say that, yeah, like those are 2 of the biggies for me right now. Witcher 3 was on that list forever. And
right.
I did finally beat it, but I haven't finished the actual DLC. So I still come back and work on it from time to time, right? Because I just, whenever I get really into it, I really enjoy it. It's kind of become my Christmas game over the past couple years.
You know what? There's nothing wrong with having a Christmas game.
Yeah, come Christmas holidays, we don't... Christmas holidays is traditionally when game journalists kind of get a break. And
yeah.
We don't have to play anything new. So that's when we can like really start going into our backlogs and everything. Last year and the year before, I used that as my opportunity to play a huge amount of The Witcher 3 over the holiday. And then subsequently, I got super into Stardew Valley for some reason.
Well, Stardew Valley is very, very easy to fall in and out of, especially back into. I hear that a huge update is coming, so I'm worried that I'm going to fall into it again.
I've got Persona 5 sitting on my PS4, and I'm actually at one of the best parts right now. But I, of course, you know, get distracted by other things. Currently, I'm distracted by FIFA, unfortunately. And I've been kind of like going, well, maybe I should put this aside and then start over with Persona 5 The Royal. But
right.
I'm actually just inclined to finish it over the holiday.
Yeah, I'm thinking I might, even though I have finished the game, I'll probably still play The Royal because I really loved Persona 5.
Before I got into the games industry, I was the kind of person who was just extremely methodical about the games that she played, where I would usually have 1 game at a time that I was playing, and I would play it and play it and play it and play it, and then I would finish it, and then I would move on to the next game. And usually I would buy one game over the holiday, that would be the game that I ended up playing, and then when I finished it, I would go to a friend or something and be like, yo, can I borrow a game? And that's what I did in Japan. Like, I would, you know, I remember borrowing Metal Gear Solid 3 from a friend and just, like, cranking through it until I finished. The problem with my current career is that I'll get really into a game and I'll be cranking through it, and then I'll have to put it down to go play another game for work, and then I'll just completely lose the thread.
Yeah, it probably doesn't help that, you know, not to sound like, oh, God, first world problems here, but we get a lot of free games to play. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too many games, honestly. And then not only that, but every single month there's some big new and interesting game that comes out. And then,
yeah. You
know, we got to, like, be on top of it, right? And actually, I prefer being able to be on a review for a game because it means that I'm definitely going to play it.
Yeah, because we like to not only review games, we also like to get angles from them and see what the fans are talking about as well.
But as I was saying, I think elsewhere, if I had not been, if not for, you know, my job, I would still be playing Fire Emblem Three Houses right now. I would be going through all of the routes. Instead, I finished one route, got halfway through another, and then I had to put it aside and go play something else.
Yeah, I haven't been able to start a new route. And in fact, one of my biggest regrets, you know, even putting aside what's on languishing on my Switch right now and my PS4, I have a 3DS that's still full of great RPGs I never finished, and it's like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get to finish them.
Yeah, no, that's the other thing is, if not for, you know, my job, I would probably just be going through Final Fantasies right now.
Yeah, like one at a time, like just like, hey, let's play Final Fantasy.
Well, again. I got super into Final Fantasy VII for a bit, if you'll recall.
Yeah, of course, and I really enjoyed talking about that, because I love Final Fantasy VII.
I wouldn't mind picking it up again come, you know, January and everything, but I started to get really guilty, because I was like, I finished this game already. I mean, it's good to have for work, but I should be playing something else.
Yeah, but, you know, it's always okay to play a classic and reappreciate it from new angles again and again and again.
I guess. I also like trying to expand my repertoire, though, so I can write about it.
That's fair. I'm bad at that.
So, I mean, I think I'm going to pick up Final Fantasy VII again come January, just because I kind of want to finish it before playing Remake.
Yes, that's a good point. We are going to have a bit of a lull until March when everything hits us again.
But I probably would have played 7, and then I probably would have played 8, and then I might have played 10, and then I might have played 12, and that would have carried me all the way until next year, you know?
Yeah, easily. Yeah. I'd love to replay 12, but I don't have the time.
So before you got into the games industry, how did you tackle backlogs?
As a kid, like, I was very much a one game at a time sort of family, because I only got them for my birthday or whatever. Super Nintendo, kind of the same thing. That's why I played Final Fantasy VI and Chrono Trigger to absolute death. But I was very much the same way. I would buy one game, I would finish it unless I totally hated it, hello Legend of Ligeia, and then I'd either borrow from a friend or save up and get a new game.
Yeah, I remember when I was blogging for 1UP a long time ago, I was in these communities where it felt like people were buying every single new game that came out, and I felt perpetually behind, and I was like, well, I'm not buying that game or that game or that game or that game, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was much more the kind of person who would be like, I would get together with a friend, and they would be like, hey, check out Fallout 3, and I'd be like, cool, yeah, that looks really neat.
Yeah, that sounds like something that's just up my alley, and it was.
And then I'd play Pokemon for another 200 hours.
Yeah, pretty much. I always had those games that I returned to still.
Yeah. All right, Thomas Nickel is a contributor. I think they are a German games journalist, and actually they have an article they're working on with us right now for submission over to US Gamer, but they had a whole bunch of thoughts on our Sega Saturn console RPG quest that we did a couple weeks ago with John Linneman.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent it in a series of tweets, so I just kind of broke them down to individual tweets. All right. The first one, while I disagree about Magic Knight Ray Earth, I think it's really well playing. Beautiful 2D cousin of Zelda and Secret of Mana was directed by the mighty Reiko Kodama. I'm just happy Linkle Liver story was mentioned. I love the combination of 2D backgrounds and 3D trees. I'll agree that Linkle Liver story is quite pretty. I really like looking at the 2D art in that game. So here's the thing, Nadia. I don't like action RPGs.
Really? Not even like Zelda? You like Zelda.
Zelda's not an action RPG. It's an action adventure game with a heavy emphasis on puzzle solving.
My brain is broken.
I've been going on about this forever. Zelda's not an RPG.
So what do you call an action RPG?
An action RPG would be any game in which you're explicitly boosting up stats, but it is still skill-based. So a game Secret of Mana is very much an action RPG. It's like the example of an action RPG. Same with Kingdom Hearts.
Right, okay.
Where you can see the little like damage counter every time you hit an enemy, but you're just like whack, 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 whack.
Yeah, and I guess I don't think there's any Zelda games that I don't even think Breath of the Wild does that. No, so yeah, okay, I like action RPGs.
Breath of the Wild has very, 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 very light RPG elements.
Compared to, like, say, A Link to the Past, yeah, definitely. Because, yeah, A Link to the Past, it's like... A Link to the Past is one of those games from the old school where the color of an enemy, like, determined how strong they were.
I just find action RPGs are often very repetitive. And I prefer the tactical turn-based elements. That said, I mean, I like, you know, The Witcher 3 and everything, but I guess I just have... I put that in a different part of my brain where I'm just really enjoying the open world aspects and everything, and the combat kind of takes a backseat to it. But even then, like, Witcher 3's combat is way better than anything you'll find in, like, Kingdom Hearts 3.
Yeah, I mean, like, what about Skyrim? That has, of course, like, the quintessential open world, but
the combat's the worst part of Skyrim.
Combat, yeah, like, I basically became an Argonian archer with, like, a million zillion stealth, and I'd just snipe everything from a million feet away.
You and everybody
that was
else.
The combat.
I mean...
It's like, here is a dangerous necromancer you must attack. Don't be very, very careful. Meanwhile, I'm up in the rafters somewhere. Just, whoop,
yeah,
headshot.
Yeah, during the whole magical college story where
yes.
you're like up in the rafters and you just have a bow and you're just like, snipe, snipe, snipe.
Ping. And they're like, who's doing that? Stop that. Like
blink,
a teacher like
blink.
Having spitballs like flung at them. Who's doing that? Stop it.
Oh, I'm dead.
Yeah. I like action RPGs because I know they are repetitive and stuff, but I kind of find that a little bit like cathartic. I like going back to Secret of Mana because I like the sensation of hacking away at an enemy.
Their next note is, it's a bit of a pity Albert Odyssey was only mentioned in passing. I think it's remarkable how working designs improved on the tech, and no love for Shining the Holy Ark. For me, it's maybe the best dungeon crawler on the console, even if the pre-rendered sprites look terrible. That's the thing. I'm totally biased against bad art.
Kat is indeed biased against bad art. I am still amazed that you love A Link Between Worlds as much as you do. It goes to show how great of a game it is.
A Link Between Worlds is pretty.
You hated it.
That's
like,
good
didn't
art.
You like hate it?
No, okay, Link's Awakening I hated.
I love Link's Awakening art. I'm so surprised you didn't like
it
that.
It has bad art.
No, it doesn't. It's so cute. It looks like candy.
It's completely at odds with the tone of the story.
That's true. It is kind of a... Well, then again, it's like the original sprites for the Game Boy game were very, very cute, too. I mean, you're still got characters named Miss Meow Meow or whatever, and Bow Wow the Chain Chomp.
And the camera zoomed in way too close. I did not like it. I thought it was bad. Katie and I are united in that. And when Katie and I agree on a thing, I know that I'm on the right side of history.
But Katie has weird takes sometimes.
Well, as I also said on Slack, I think today... I'm never sure what she's going to like and what she's going to hate.
Me neither. Sometimes I'm seriously surprised when I'm like, oh, I love Dragon Quest XI. She's like, yeah, me too. I'm like, what?
She's like, I love this game. But then there'll be a game where she just decides that she hates it and puts it away and never looks at it again. There was a game she was talking about just today where I'm like, really? You hate it? Eh, whatever.
when we work long enough with Katie, it's just like, eh, whatever, when that happens.
Mid-tier titles like Shining Wisdom or Dark Savior are really expensive nowadays. Both have problems, but they're interesting. The first started development on Mega Drive and has two different localizations. The other was considered a sequel to Landstalker, but it wasn't. I've actually been kind of leaving a lot of action RPGs off these lists when we're doing the console RPG quests, I should add.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. And I will admit that the Saturn is one of my more shameful bald spots because it is
a
something...
bald spot. I love it.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I would love to cover it up. I would love to get more into its library because it has such a unique angle of RPG history that no other console has. But there's no real easy way to fill it in.
And then there's Inhales. Tengai Makio Daion no Mokushiroku, The Apocalypse 4. What a beast of an RPG. A wonderfully weird interpretation of anime, huge anime cell enemies, great music, maybe the best classical RPG alongside Grandia. Nadia, my main takeaway from the Sega Saturn is that it may not be the best RPG console around, but it is definitely full of the most intriguing oddities of any of the RPG consoles.
Yes, it was definitely, like, I've really come to appreciate how the Saturn stands on its own as an RPG console. It ideally, going back, if I could go back in time and relive that part of gaming history, I'd find a way to buy both the PlayStation and the Saturn because they're such different, again, just such different branches of RPG history, but they both should be experienced.
The Saturn would have been wonderful to import circa 2002, where a lot of this stuff was still quite obscure and very fresh and new and interesting. and we were in a different mindset in terms of gaming history, I think I would have fallen head over heels for the Sega Saturn's RPG library.
Yeah, I would have too. Was it like, but a lot of it also is like in Japanese, and I can't read Japanese. You can.
Yeah, but not that well. I mean, when I was living in Japan, I got just to the point where I was able to start to understand what was happening without having to read the translations just by looking at the kanji, but then I lost it.
Yeah, if you don't use a language, you lose it, unfortunately. That's the problem with language.
Yeah, and that was the problem, was that there weren't a lot of fan translations back then. It was just harder. So, I mean, you could find game facts and things like that to help you out, but yeah, you had to work really hard. Okay, Daniel Cole says, I want to bring your attention to one game you missed. Okay, so they're talking about Sega Genesis RPGs. This is a reference to our Sega Genesis console RPG quest. Mm-hmm. Super Highlight. An open-world action RPG, but with hardcore RPG mechanics where you had to eat, sleep, and weight mattered. It also added cool things like having good and bad monsters, and though it was hidden if you killed the good monsters, the game got incredibly hard and almost unbeatable. It also had an early class system where you choose to be a warrior, a thief, and leveling and use of magic were incredibly different for each class. Story was also good in that it started high fantasy, but then went sci-fi about halfway through and had some interesting things to say. The one issue was difficulty. Even in the area of Phantasy Star games, letting you put yourself in unwinnable states, like using the one dynamite in the game, which was unnecessary to open a dungeon door in combat, and requiring grinding, this game was hard. I didn't beat it until much later, and only by using the internet to look up the trick for the final boss. Nadia, you were making noises of recognition. Is this a game that you know?
I know it because one game that we neglected to mention on the Saturn was Virtual Highlight, which is hilariously bad, and I recommend you look up a walkthrough if you ever have time, because it's the funniest thing you'll see all year, probably. It's really, really, really terrible. I do know that the first Highlight, I never played it. That was for the NES, but it had like a really, really aggressive ad campaign that made the game look really cool. It wasn't. But, like, I used to read a lot of Archie comics and stuff when I was a kid. They always advertised the game in there. Super Highlight? Is that what it was? Like, I never played that. But it sounds like it's probably better than the original Highlight, which was more of a discount ease. And Virtual Highlight, which, of course, was a disaster and a half.
So, Highlight is an interesting case because it didn't come out in America until 1989. And it almost immediately started getting compared to The Legend of Zelda, and not favorably.
Yeah. No. It was one of those games where you killed enemies by running into them, and you just hoped your HP were higher.
Yeah. So it seems like Super Highlight is maybe the highlight of the series.
Yeah. I didn't get to play it, but I have heard decent things about it.
And finally, Pinsta says, I found my PSP in storage last week, and I ended up falling back into R-Type Command. Hard. Oh, man. R-Type Command, Nadia. Did you ever see that one?
No, I did not. That sounds like something you'd like, though.
I liked it. It was a... It took R-Type, which was a shoot-em-up, and turned it into a tactics game. Now, it wasn't like an isometric tactics game. It looked just like an R-Type, where it was like horizontal and everything, and you're fighting the alien empire and all that, except that it was grid-based. And when you are attacking enemies, you would kind of like Super Robot Wars cut into an animated, a really nice 3D animated attack cutscene. It was great.
That's pretty cool. That does sound really cool. I like the idea of combining just two genres that have no business being together and making a good game out of it.
Nuts and gum together at last.
Nuts and gums together at last. I'm a white male, age 30 years old. Everyone listens to me, no matter how stupid my ideas are.
I know you guys have done multiple RPGs over the different consoles lately, but I'm hoping to hear Nadia and recommendations more for space sci-fi RPGs off the beaten path. If any of them happen to be tactics RPGs, even better. Okay, here's a game that I'm going to recommend that's coming out on Steam soon, if it's not already out. SD Gundam G-Generation Crossrays, which is kind of similar to R-Type Command in some ways. Maybe people have listened to me talk about SD Gundam on this podcast in the past. It's always been coming out on PSP and PS Vita over the years. The upshot is you are playing through different maps in the Gundam universe in different stories, and you are slowly but surely building up an army of Gundams. And you start out with the most basic units, and as you level them up, they evolve, right? Mm-hmm. And you can evolve them into the next level. And as they get higher level, you can spend X amount of money to exchange them for other units, and then again keep evolving them. And so your goal is to unlock different kind of chains so that you can get to the units that you want.
Wow, that actually sounds pretty cool. I like the idea of just making an army of Gundams.
Yes, and it's very satisfying when you get like one of your absolute favorites finally onto your team, and you're like, yes. And then, of course,
Tequila Gundam.
No, Tequila Gundam, alas, has never been in it.
Yeah,
to my knowledge, they always only have the main characters from G Gundam.
Okay, that's fair.
But then also you spend money on the pilots as well, and you can stick them in. And then you can put them into pretty much any unit that you want, so it can be a lot of fun to mix and match.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Unfortunately, I can't think off the top of my head of, like, spaced RPGs I like, because, I don't know, space has never interested me as much as just, you know, good old terrain.
I mean, some of the problem is that JRPGs set in space are not only somewhat few and far between, but also kind of bad.
Yeah, I would say the notable exception, of course, is the Phantasy Star universe, which, gosh, the first game itself is so interesting in that in a time, like, even before the West had Final Fantasy, Sega had a game where you would visit a spaceport and visit the neighboring world and stuff like that. It was still very much, you know, sword and sorcery a little bit with, you know, with occasional gun and what have you. It was those plans were more of, okay, here's an excuse to visit a desert world. Here's an excuse to visit, like, a lush world. But it still very much was steeped in sci-fi roots.
I would say that there are a lot of games that kind of make motions toward being sci-fi games, but actually what they are is kind of steampunk, and they don't really go into space.
Yeah, like a good example, I think, is Final Fantasy VI, which has a lot of steampunk to it, but isn't exactly sci-fi.
I was looking at some recommendations that other people were making, and people were talking about Star Control as an RPG.
Yeah, the original Star Control, I think, is more about fighting and dogfighting, whereas the second one really is about exploration, leveling up your ship, and fighting monsters, and, of course, a crazy-ass story.
Okay, so that is the end of our mailbag for the week. Thanks to everybody who submitted. Do you want to be part of the Accidental Blood God mailbag? Well, this is how you can do it. You can send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net, or you can send me a DM on Twitter. And it seems like this mailbag is kind of becoming a thing that we do every month now.
Yeah, I like the idea of just kind of catching up with people.
Yeah, I want to hear from the audience. I want to talk to you. My loyal warriors of the Blood God, I'm sure you have plenty of thoughts on RPGs. Okay, so Axe of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Follow me on Twitter at @_Catpod. Nadia is @NadiaOxford. Make sure to give us a review. Make sure to subscribe to our newsletter. And do me a favor and go on our site and read all of our great coverage. Nadia has been killing it with our Pokemon coverage. Nadia, I finally saw the Galarian Mouth not too long ago, just last night, actually. And you are right. It looks like a homeless Totoro.
It's great, isn't it? I love that stupid thing. It scared the crap out of me when I saw it. Its eyes. Look at its eyes and its mouth. Just these seven sharp, serrated teeth.
Terrifying. Also, I did a big deep dive look into the history of the lightsaber in games, from Jedi Fallen Order to Bushido Blade, the 35-year quest for the perfect video game lightsaber. And I spent a lot of time on that article and actually did a fair amount of research for it, so do me a favor and go and read it. In the meantime, we're just about to the holidays. We are putting together a whole bunch of gift guides. One of them by Nadia is for people who like retro games and nostalgia games may appeal to Blood God listeners. So you might want to check that out. And then it's on into the Game of the Year period, in which we get to talk about all look back on 2019. There are so many games that came out this year that I totally forgot about. I totally forgot that Ace Combat 7 came out this year, Nadia.
Oh, I heard that was good. I mean, it always has great music. I know that much.
All right. But well, please look forward to that. But as usual, we'll be back next week. But until then, for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening. Until next time, happy adventuring.